All right, Ms. Walton. Perfect. All right, back on the record, December 19th, 2023, 225. I'm Phil Ulbrich's hearing examiner, Silverview Appeal. Ms. Clungeon was just bringing up her witness, Mr. Matthews.
Yes, could we have him brought over?
There he is. Okay, Mr. Matthews, just unmute yourself. Let me swear you in again.
Okay, sorry,
there
Mr.
he is.
Examiner.
All right, just raise your right hand. Do you swear affirm tell the truth, nothing but the truth in this proceeding?
I do.
Great, all right, great. Thank you. Welcome, and go ahead, Ms. Clungeon.
All right. And Mr. Matthew, did you listen to Mr. Oh, geez, I'm going to forget the Mr.
Pachowski?
Pachowski? What was the pronunciation?
It's Piowski.
Piowski. All right, apologies. Piowski, were you present for Mr. Piowski's testimony?
I was present, yes.
Okay, great. For your rebuttal testimony here, I want to touch on a couple of the statements. First, let's talk about a little the risk to the puncture of the artesian aquifer. Do you recall that discussion?
I do.
Okay, and we established that the testimony was the risk was low, but not zero. Do you recall that?
Yes.
Okay. And is that consistent with your understanding as well?
It is. Yes. I agree with that statement.
Okay. Well, while the risk is low, it's not zero. What would the consequences of an aquifer breach be on this site? And would they be significant?
An aquifer breach would be significant, and it could be catastrophic. Basically, if you did breach that artesian aquifer and water was allowed to flow and move upward to ground surface, it could be really disruptive to the construction of this development. Furthermore, that water could flow downhill, and flowing downhill, it would erode and cause a mess, so to speak, in the downgrading neighborhood area. So because of those consequences, it's really important that breach is thoroughly investigated.
Okay. Mr. Piowski also made some statements about the shallow aquifer and that there were some areas where they were wet, but he debated the permeability of some of it and determined that it wasn't a shallow aquifer. What's your response to that?
My response is that there is a shallow aquifer there. And furthermore, other geotechnical and hydrogeologists that have worked on the site have also identified water in borings and in soil pits across the site in the upper, say, 5 to 10 feet. And some of those locations are different from where the current consultant has found water. But nevertheless, there is water there. I call it a shallow aquifer. And there are permeable sediments in there that will allow that water to be transmitted. And those sediments also store that water. That water provides, it's a source of water to the on-site wetland, for example, and it's a source of water to the downgrading neighborhood. And it also is a source of water for a spring that I actually saw on the slope of the property, at the southern end of the property. It's probably an intermittent spring. But nevertheless, that water is stored and does transmit through that shallow zone. I call it an aquifer. It has a function. That water has a function there.
You cut out there, for me at least, very briefly when you said it provides water to downgradient something, and I didn't hear the word after downgradient.
It provides water to the downgradient neighborhood, Mr. Brickland. And in that neighborhood are wetlands. Are other water features like a pond, an open channel that has water in it, And ultimately, that water does provide part of the mix that goes into the lagoon. So it has a significant function.
Okay. And in your review of the report, did they assess those functions or the project's impacts to those functions?
Not at all. I never saw any of those features mentioned in terms of, you know, how much water, the rate at which water flows to those features in the downgrading neighborhood area and the lagoon, and, you know, in terms of rates, quantities, durations, nothing of that sort.
Okay. I'm just going to bring up just the one of the exhibits here, related to just the decision. This is exhibit F7 at page 9. I want to look at this item, this finding of the hearing examiner, number 13. Are you able to see this?
Yes, I can.
Okay. And let me read here. So groundwater discharge impacts must be adequately evaluated. The project will increase impervious surface, increasing surface runoff, and decreasing on-site infiltration. Lost infiltration has the potential to impact on-site and off-site wetlands, down-gradient drinking, water wells, non-wetland vegetation reliant on shallow groundwater flow, and the lagoon. There is inadequate analysis on these issues as to allow for independent evaluation. Based on Mr. Piowski's testimony, did he address any of these issues that were raised by the examiner in the previous decision?
No, he did not. But all he did was identify there was some shallow water in a couple of the borings they did, and a few of the borings they did. But okay. Yeah, these issues were not addressed with respect to the shallow aquifer.
Okay. And he made some, regarding the finding of water in shallow borings, I just want to pull up your exhibit. So this is Appellant's Exhibit 8. Which was the report, and I believe we looked at an image, a figure there. Let me try and pull it up. So this will be on page 15. One second, screen share. All right, are you able to see this?
Yes.
Okay, and he made some statements about these annotations that you made of this figure in their report. Do you recall that?
I do recall that, yes.
Okay. And here we've got these bore holes that he said in half of them, we found some shallow groundwater. Is that reflected here?
Yes. Let's see, okay. There was 4 of 8. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yep.
During your report and during your testimony, you made it clear that these annotations were yours, correct?
Yes, I said we encircle these in this blue or cyan color. Yeah.
Okay. And you did that on this, and as well as I think another image showing the multiple times that they had found water in boring holes throughout the site, correct?
Correct. There was two other consultant reports that I show in this report,
mm-hmm.
Where we encircled the borings or the test pits, the soil test pits, with a blue or a cyan circle showing where they found groundwater, saturated conditions. And yes, you brought up one of the other images.
Yep,
this
so
one
this
is one. Actually, yeah, this one actually has the deep borings that were done and the shallow test pits that were done.
Okay, and this is exhibit 8 at page 9. And during your testimony, you made it clear that these were your annotations based on the data that's been provided by the applicant, correct?
That is correct.
Okay. okay. And then I just want to touch on, there was a statement about basically some of your recommendation for groundwater monitoring, and that it was not typical. Do you have a response to that?
Well, yes, I do. I have a response. This is a very large site, and it has potential to make a very significant impact on the hydrology, both on site and downgrading off site. And the monitoring and or quantification and of water and its storage and movement is warranted for a site of this size and of this potential significant impact. And so, yes, I believe that 15 months of monitoring, so we understand what is moving through the site and discharge being discharged from the site, is really important. With that understanding, then you can actually figure out what the impacts will be.
Okay. Covered that there. Also, just following up, there was discussion of groundwater, but there did Mr. Piowski's testimony, it did not include any discussion of surface water in any way, right? Correct? Do you recall?
That is correct. That is
okay.
Correct. He missed an important part of the water budget, you know, on site and off site, which is the movement of surface water that discharges from the site.
Okay. And I think that most covers it. Was there anything else in his testimony that you'd like to respond to?
I think that covers it, Ms.
Okay.
Lynn. Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Matthew.
Thank Mr. you. Lynn, any cross?
One question. You indicated he didn't talk about surface water. We've had lots of conversation about surface water from other experts, though, have we not?
You've had talk about it, but there's no characterization of how much surface water is moving out off site. For example, out the southwest corner of the site, there's no quantification of that. So,
have you read the storm report?
Yeah, I did. I read it, but I don't see any field work or field data that supports some of the quantities, and that's all about peak flow too, Mr. Lynn. It's not necessarily about flow other than peak flows.
Yeah, my question was just, did you read it? So, and I think I have my answer to that. So thank you. And that's all I have. Get back to your wedding fun.
Thank you.
Mr. Getches, any questions?
No questions, thanks.
All right. And Ms. Klung, any redirect?
No.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Mr. Matthew. Thank you again for coming over. All right. Ms. Klung, I take it. Oh.
Sorry.
Your next witness, I guess.
I believe it's, so it would be Mr. Adams, and it would be Mr. Lynn's cross of Mr. Adams, but I believe we went a little faster than I was anticipating, so let me check in with him.
Okay.
He says that, I just got a text saying he's not available. Well, ETA is 2:40. So I think if we could just maybe have 5 or 10 minutes, then he will be available and we can wrap that up.
Okay. Yeah, I'll just wait to see. Why don't you have your screen appear and then we'll all come back on once you have them
okay.
on.
All right. Thank you.
Okay, let's make sure Mr. Lynn gets back on and then we can get started. Okay, there he is. All right, back on the record, December 19th, 2023, 2:41 p.m. on the Silverview Apartment Appeal. Ms. Klung is bringing up Mr. Adams for cross-examination from Mr. Lynn. So, Mr. Adams, let me swear in again real quick. Just raise your right hand. Do you swear affirm, tell the truth, nothing but the truth in this proceeding?
I do.
Okay, great. All right, Mr. Lynn, go ahead.
Good afternoon. Let me check and see if Ruben is with us. He was going to pull up something for me.
Yep.
Good afternoon.
Ruben, can I get you to pull up the design guidelines, please? Really looking initially at page one. And maybe you could, I don't know if you can make that a little larger. I'm looking at the second paragraph there that talks about regional growth centers. It describes Silverdale as a regional growth center, and then says, and this is, I'm reading from the second paragraph, page one, regional growth centers are intended to be dense and diverse urban centers with regional focus on significant business, comma, cultural, comma, governmental, comma, residential, and recreational facilities. Development should result in compact and centralized working, shopping, and activity areas linked by transit. In your review of this, which I gather was pretty broad, did you encounter that statement?
Sure. Yes, I read this first chapter. Thank you.
Okay. And in your analysis, does this description of what this whole area is intended to be have a bearing on your interpretation? That it's supposed to be a dense area with mixed uses?
Sure. Yeah. Over the entire Silverdale, you know, district, the whole planning district. Sure.
Right. But I mean, and this site has the capacity for multifamily residences, doesn't it? So wouldn't that suggest
yes.
this is an area for that where dense housing is a possibility anyway?
Correct.
Okay. And Ruben, would you scroll down? You mentioned the number one below that talked about building going up rather than out, and then at the same time preserving views. Did you see in number three that it specifically talks about promoting quality housing?
Yes, I see that.
Okay. And likewise, in paragraph five, doesn't it say the same thing, to promote quality housing? Isn't that another one of the goals of this area?
Yes, I see that.
Okay. So let's, I know you talked about section 2.1, so maybe we could scroll to that. And you relied on this section that talked about sort of what to do with the defining characteristics or the physical identity elements of each of the sub areas. And you emphasized 2.1, the last line of the first paragraph, that it said, design guidelines are based on these special features where possible, protecting, enhancing, or incorporating these features in a new development pattern. And I think I recalled your testimony that this was a place where you saw that the special characteristics were to be protected. Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay. So if views are one of those areas, what about the statement that says incorporating these features in a new development pattern? Doesn't that support the creation of a new view opportunities in new development patterns for the benefit of residents? Isn't that what incorporating these features in a new development pattern means?
Again, I think these are broad statements across the entire Silverdale district, so it's hard to apply the views only to the subject parcel. You have to incorporate the views for the neighboring parcels in the waterfront district. I think that's what I was suggesting. I'm yeah. not suggesting that the subject parcel isn't entitled to views as well. Of course they are.
Okay. So let's talk about yards just briefly. This is not going to take very long, but if we could go to 9.4.2, which is the specific section for this sub area. Yeah, a little for 4.2. So you pointed out to 9.4.2b that said front yard may be defined as. The word may there means that it's possible, doesn't it? Or allowable, not required?
Yes, they're saying that the definition of front yard here can incorporate these elements that they're listing, but they don't have to incorporate all of them.
Okay. So doesn't this expand what we might otherwise think of as a front yard to incorporate other optional front yards?
Not really. I think these are all things that are customarily part of a front yard, in my opinion.
Well, it says defined as, so you think these would have to occur in the front yard in order to meet the definition?
No, as I suggested before, the front yard is defined with the paragraph above, for example, where it says that the major entries will be oriented to and accessible from a front yard. That's part of that. That is the thing that is a requirement of the front yard, because that has the statement will in that sentence.
I see. Okay. And the terms rear and side yard are not separately defined in any way in these guidelines, are they?
No, but they're defined by exclusion, if that's the proper term for it. There are no other yards that are defined, and so you're left with the side and the rear yard. You're basically left with all the other yards once the front yard is defined.
You mean you would be left with them as they're defined elsewhere in the city's codes?
No, you don't need to, because they basically are saying that you can't have parking in the front yard. So that's what you know, that's the definition, if you will, by exclusion.
So it has to be someplace else other than that side?
Other than that yard, yes.
So, okay, well, I don't think I'm going to wade deeper into the design process. Let's go to exhibit or figure 3-4, which is one you cited as an example of where parking should be located. Mm-hmm. First of all, that's in a different sub area, is it? That's a special sub area that's different than the waterfront area, isn't it?
Yes, but this sub area was referenced specifically as a model for the waterfront district.
And where did you see that?
Have to look at my notes again here, but I believe
that's all right. I don't want to belabor it. I guess we can find it when we breathe.
Yes, it's in the exhibit that I prepared for this testimony, okay. And I referenced that reference in my exhibit.
Okay, so Ruben, could you scroll? I guess it's up a little bit so we can see the reference to figure 3.4. I mean, this is not an exhibit that attempts to show where parking is to be located. Doesn't it specifically say that this is an example of how to show a continuous front yard or a street frontage in a commercial area?
Yeah. Yes, Mr. Nguyen, but the whole point, what I was trying to say is that as architects and as designers, we look at these models for guidance. These are complex issues. There's no prescriptive mathematical solution to these design problems. And so as designers, we look to these types of examples, which 3.4 is, to show us how you could possibly locate parking. They did not show parking in this diagram. They showed very clearly how they wanted alley access parking here. They didn't just show the facade. So it isn't limited. This diagram isn't limited just to showing the facade. Clearly, you can all see that it shows more than just the facade.
Yeah, I understand that. Each of the figures shows a multiplicity of things. I guess my question was, so you don't feel it's out of reach to go to another sub area for another use, commercial, and a figure designed for another purpose to get some ideas about what this owner should have to do in a different area?
No, it's not out of reach at all. In fact, the area is specifically, the sub area is specifically referenced in Silverdale Design Standards 2.5.2, where it says the landscape front yard pattern of Old Town is to be incorporated in the waterfront district.
I think we'll get back to that, but let me ask you another question here. I'm going to bounce through my notes. You indicated that underground parking or underbuilding parking, I'm sorry, was feasible. Did you undertake any financial feasibility analysis as to the cost of that or the impact on the economics of the project from losing units if they were replaced by parking?
Nope, I did not. And I would...
The question, so I don't really need okay. further discussion. Your attorney can certainly bring that out. I think I actually just have a couple more questions. You gave other examples of, and I think you said you don't design apartments yourself.
That's correct.
Okay. So the examples that you gave the examiner in terms of what would be an appropriate architecture here were one from Sea Ranch in California. That is a coastal resort. Is that correct?
It was originally conceived as a multifamily residential project. It's currently, you're correct, Mr. Lynn, it has been subsequently purchased and turned into a resort. That is correct. Well, but it was originally developed as a multifamily residential.
It's certainly not an example of what could be built here and be affordable to the residents who are intended to live and work in this area, are they?
I'm simply talking about the geometric possibility of stepping a building down the hillside.
Okay. And is the same true of Alderbrook, which is actually a pretty high-end waterfront resort?
Again, just demonstrating the geometric possibility of stepping a building down the site.
Okay. So would you agree that stepping down the building and following topography is generally a good thing to be accomplished under good design principles?
It often is a very good strategy, sure.
Okay. That's all I have. Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Getches, do you have any questions?
Sure. Maybe just a couple. Let's see if I can pull up an exhibit here. We're just at the Silverdale design standards again. And you touched on this a little bit where you, when you were testifying originally on direct, you were talking about the Old Town District quite a bit. Do you recall that?
Good afternoon. Yes, I do.
And the block grid system that they have there. You see that? And you're discussing that should be applied in the waterfront district. We'll look at the key so we know that's the waterfront district. Waterfront district is this, where you see the subject property right here. Over there. And yes. Is the only place where you're getting that, well, how many design districts are there? Do you know off the top of your head?
I don't know. Is okay, seven plus or minus?
Let's look. I think there's nine.
Nine.
Right. So you've got, or maybe since you start on number three, maybe it is seven. Let's see. One, two, three, four, five, six, seven, eight, nine. Okay, and they each have their own physical characteristics and their own descriptions, right?
Yes.
But you're borrowing from Old Town when you're analyzing waterfront, all because of 252?
Correct.
Is that any other place other than 252 that says that, so for example, the grid, if you go to 9, well, if you go to Old Town, you'll see it mentioned all the time in the description of Old Town. Let's go there. That's page 19. Let me move this a little bit. Go down to 3 for Old Town. Old Town. Block grid right there in the description. But if you go to 9, where Waterfront District is, do you recall seeing anything in 9 that references a grid or a block grid in 9?
The reference is, as I mentioned, in 2.52.
Okay, let's go.
Yeah, references the front yard pattern, which by implication gives you, and as I said to Mr. Lin, gives you guidance as a designer of what you know, what models you might try to follow. And the front yard pattern will drive you towards a grid typology. When it says based on the historic Old Town typology, that's a pretty strong indicator as a designer and as someone who's laying out, a set of buildings, more than one building, laying out a property full of buildings, of how we might approach the installation of these buildings across a large site.
That's great. Let me, and I don't mean to be rude, but let me see if I can follow it here. So key mm-hmm. features of the Silverdale open space system will include. So each of these bullets you're applying to the entire Silverdale unincorporated area, even if it says something like in the Old Town, you have this in West Hill neighborhood in Waterfront District. Oh, it does name Waterfront District. Front yard pattern. Yeah, it also doesn't name grid, and you're implying it from that, though, right?
I'm fairly implying that when it says topology based on the front yards, that's gonna get you. It's gonna very quickly get you to that grid pattern. I wouldn't bore you to death, but we could do a historical analysis of urban grid patterns, in Western. land use planning traditions, and front yard pattern like this will quickly get you to a grid setup in North America. It's how we design our cities.
But right now it's not in a grid. And in the description of the waterfront.
Old Town's in a grid.
Old Town is, but Waterfront's not in a grid. And in the description of Waterfront District, do you recall seeing the word grid anywhere in that entire description?
There's no word grid in that description.
No, but there is all over the place in Old Town, right?
Again, I suggest it's hard to do the Old Town typology without applying the grid. It's endemic in the Old Town district. So it's hard to apply that topology without applying the grid. They kind of go hand in hand.
But it's not a grid now, right? And even if you zoom in on the one below it, I mean, you've got the plots next to each other, but as far as a grid road system that resembles this, wouldn't you agree it looks quite a bit different than this right now?
That's not the intent of the code. The intent is to apply that type of street structure to new developments. And in fact, there is some code, and I don't have it right here in front of me, that says, no, when you do have a large, undivided parcel, you want to get to a grid structure that is by reference, similar to the Old Town grid structure.
Where did you see that?
You'd either have to give me some time to look it up again, or you could get it from me on Cross. I don't have it right here in front of me.
Yeah.
Working from memory on that one.
Okay. But as far as something more clear language that creates a mandate that, so for example, let's say we'd required something like that and it got appealed and the hearings examiner asked us why we denied it. And we said, well, because this is required. And they asked, well, where's the requirement? You know, in terms of like, let's see, let's look at 1.3 for a second. 1.3, mandatory versus interpretive standards. Just the common, what you would normally see, will, must, shall indicate mandatory standard. You would agree there's nothing in here that we could point to that contains a mandatory requirement of a grid system. Is that right? You're kind of implying it from a few other things.
Our work as designers, as I've tried to be clear in the testimony, is that there are these requirements and these standards aren't always 100% prescriptive. They require interpretation. They require the inference from a design professional to take all of these breadcrumbs, if you will, these design concepts, and then apply them in a specific way in a particular project. So these guidelines, as discussed in this same chapter, talk about the complexity of these requirements. If you do none of the characterizations that are contained in these guidelines, are you following them? Are you only required to follow the will and must? Then why even put the other concepts in there? I mean, I'll leave that for the legal scholars among us to discuss, but as a designer, I need to figure out ways of incorporating some of these concepts in here. And I appreciate that a design guideline gives me as a designer some flexibility and doesn't make you will have 3 feet between, you know, every front door or some kind of, you know, prescriptive requirement on every aspect of design, because then I won't be able to design for specific conditions.
You appreciate the flexibility. And would you agree the flexibility allows reasonable minds to differ?
Yes, I do.
Okay.
The problem is I haven't seen the application meet almost any of the requirements of Chapter 9. I mean, we could go through the requirements of Chapter 9 one by one, and you will find that the application isn't meeting any of those requirements. It's kind of shocking, frankly. It's a fun exercise to do at night, you know, when you pull up Chapter 9 and read through it and see if the proposal meets any of the requirements. It doesn't. It doesn't meet it barely meets any of the guidance in there. The soft terms you were referring to, the coulds and the cans and the shoulds.
Okay. Think. Yeah, I think that's all I've got.
Okay, thanks, Mr. Getchis. Ms. Klung?
Stop share.
I'm muted. Okay, there we go. Yeah, I just have a couple of questions. Okay. Good afternoon, Mr. Adams.
Good afternoon.
Following up on Mr. Lin's question, he pointed to sort of, I'm not sure if it's page one, but the idea was that to promote quality housing, do you recall?
Yes.
Right. But in your analysis, hold on, how do I want to say this? From this reading, would it suggest that promoting quality housing is to build in conformance with the Silverdale design standards?
Yeah, absolutely. If you're trying to create a quality built environment in general, not just housing, but a quality built environment, many communities set up design standards in order to enforce that quality, which is a harder thing to pin down, right? That's the stuff that's difficult, requires a little bit more judgment, is complex. Quality is hard to quantify. And so, yes, the design standards are in place in part to enforce a certain quality in the built environment.
Okay. Regarding the physical identity element, when they were talking about views, Mr. Lin suggested, you know, incorporating it in the development. I think you mostly responded to it to say that it applies to both the exit. Well, I'll actually let you say it. Scrap that. For the physical identity elements, there's language about incorporating views for new developments. Do the design standards, is there a suggestion that it doesn't also include existing development?
I'm sorry, you're gonna have to repeat that. Sorry. I kind of lost you.
Yep, that's okay. I lost me too. For the views and the physical identity elements, does that apply to both new and existing development?
The views are there, and they exist around existing development for sure, and not exactly sure what you're asking, but the idea is that there in a dense area like this, there is an acknowledgement that existing development is there and has, you know, their rights, if you will, to views. So the subject parcel, I try to say, does have rights to views. I'm not saying it doesn't. That is because by virtue of being in the waterfront district, it has access to views too. But so do all the neighboring parcels that are in that waterfront district. And if they're developed on, there's views from those developed parcels, you know, presumably.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I don't think we need to go into yards. I think that was addressed. Let's see. I want to talk briefly about the parking. Mr. Lin asked you about whether you undertook any sort of analysis to determine the financial impact of underground parking. Do you recall that?
Yes.
Do you recall from the application materials, there's the applicant, there are statements regarding that underground parking is not feasible. Do you recall any of those?
Yes.
Okay. Was there any analysis provided or any data that you saw to back that up regarding feasibility?
No.
Okay.
Not that I recall.
Okay. And is there anything in the design guidelines that suggests that the cost to implement something somehow exempts the building from conformance with these design standards?
No. And in fact, I would go on to say that we often, as people that work in the construction industry, are required to make improvements to existing structures or make design concessions to new structures that are financially detrimental to some accountant's bottom line. For instance, you often find yourself in existing structures putting in elevators, which are very expensive to install, but that's what the accessibility code insists on new or redeveloped buildings. And so, you know, financial impact is typically something that is sort of the last consideration in determining whether, you know, whether or not you do something to meet the code or not. It's pretty hard to show financial hardship for a lot of against a lot of codes.
Okay. There was some discussion about the Sea Ranch and suggesting that it was, you know, now a resort. You had pictures of Sea Ranch that is more, I just think, described as high end. Are there other lower cost projects that step down in a similar manner?
Yeah, it's pretty common to see buildings stepping with the landscape. I will emphasize that this is not a particularly steeply sloping site. I think on this site in particular, the applicant really had free rein to orient the buildings, however, made the project in better compliance with the design guidelines.
And they chose not to in this case, correct?
Yes.
Okay. And so did you just use Sea Ranch because it was a good image, not to suggest that only higher priced projects could step down?
Yeah, it's a very illustrative image because the shape of the buildings clearly show to any observer who looks at the photograph how the building is stepping with the land. So it's very demonstrative of that kind of architecture.
Okay. And okay, moving on to a little bit of the discussion about the, I believe it was Mr. Getchis's discussion about grids in the waterfront. And, you know, you pointed to, I'm trying to remember which, I think it was up in chapter two regarding Old Town and a grid system, but nothing that was in the waterfront specifically that called for a grid. Do you recall that?
Yes.
Okay. But during your testimony, you did lay out, and I'm going to share my screen here. You did address this in your testimony here. So this is not the Silverdale design standards, but it is the Kitsap County Code on multifamily site design and orientation. Do you see that here?
Yes.
So 17470030. And yep. These guidelines here under B, can you read number one for me?
Yep. Use a modified street grid system where most buildings in a project front on a street, where no public streets exist, create a modified grid street system within the project.
Okay. So would this indicate that this design should have featured a grid system as well?
Yep. Yeah, this is exactly, thank you for fronting, it's the reference that I had in mind that I wasn't able to remember.
Mm-hmm. And I believe he also discussed, you know, there's something about, let's see here. Actually, no, that's unnecessary. Okay, one second, I might be close to done here. Okay, all right, I don't think I have any, well, before I let you go, is there anything else that Mr. Lin or Mr. Getchis asked you about that you'd like to respond to?
Nope, I think that's it. Thank you.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Adams.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Adams. This could be the last time you're here. I can't make any guarantees, but three times is probably enough. So thanks for your testimony. Much appreciated. Thank you. All right. So, Ms. Klug, I think that's it, right, for today?
That is it.
Okay. So, well, can we set a date then for Dr. Cook? And I think that is the very last witness, right, that we're dealing with at this point? Yeah. So you were mentioning early January.
On my calendar, I have that she does not return until January 7th. So it'd be after that. She's also not available on the 10th.
Right. She says she's back on January 7th with a 9-hour time difference that day. And you're right. She is. So let's see. What day of the week is January 7th?
That's a Sunday.
It's a Sunday.
Yeah. So maybe give her a couple of days, maybe Wednesday of that week. Or no, well, that's the 10th. That's the day you say she's not available.
Correct.
So either Tuesday or Thursday, the 9th or the 11th, maybe? Yes. Let me see what I've got going those 2 days.
So the county has a different hearing scheduled for the 11th from 9 to noon, I believe. So.
Okay. So 12th then, Friday, does that work for everybody? 9 o'clock?
What happened to the 9th? Was that an option?
I have the I have a hearing at 10 o'clock on the 9th, but it's I'm almost positively done by noon, so I could do the afternoon of the 9th.
Yeah, that's open for me too.
Tuesday the 9th of January? Mm-hmm. That's open for me.
Okay. That works for me as well.
All right. Ms. Klung, okay?
Yes, that's
fine. All right. So, Ms. Walston, I take it the 9th, 1 o'clock?
The 9th will work at, I'm sorry, say it again, 1 o'clock?
Yeah.
Okay, so 1 to 5, 9 on, sorry, January 9th, 1 to 5.
Okay, that should be the last hearing date, so I'll see you then.
Great.
Okay, thanks, everybody.
Thanks, everyone.
Good holidays.
Thank you.